Before we get rolling, a quick note that this episode does feature real uncensored conversation amongst real uncensored adults, and some of the language used reflects that. Otherwise, enjoy.
I hope to be a writer myself someday.
Hello, world. Welcome to Living to Write, where we talk with notable writers about their methods, journeys, and advice for other writers. I'm Brian Landwehr, and I'm a writer. If you are too, or just want to know more about writers and writing, you are in the right place. With me each episode is my accomplice, Bailey Patterson, who is both a talented writer and the talented producer of this podcast. Hello over there, Bailey.
Why, hello, Brian. Hello, listeners.
I think we've got an interesting one today. I'm sure that most of our listeners assume naturally that Bailey and I are roughly the same age, thanks to my unbounded youthful verve. But spoiler alert, I'm actually a bit older than my good friend Bailey here. And like any good friend, I'm going to use that to put Bailey on the spot now. Or maybe not. We'll see how this goes.
Ready for anything.
Bailey, do you know who Tracy Ullman is?
I do.
Oh.
I know the name, but I can't. This is so embarrassing, Brian. So, Brian, would you mind telling everyone who Tracy Ullman is?
Well, I will. I think we're done putting you on the spot.
Thank you.
She's a British comedian, singer, and writer, and I think she was best known in the U.S. for the Tracy Ullman Show, mm-hmm. which was a show on Fox in the late 80s. And the reason I'm bringing her up, I'm going to get there in sort of a roundabout way. When I was in college, which was obviously not that long ago because I'm so young, I went to a film festival on campus. And it was a variety of shorts. A few of them were animated, very few of them. But there was in there an animated short of The Simpsons. At the time, The Simpsons was very new. And the reason I brought Tracy Ullman up is that The Simpsons started as a segment on her show before there was a Simpsons show. And that's how the characters got started. And by the way, it is really interesting to go back and look at the art style back in those early days. But there was just nothing else like it on television. And it had been a while since a big deal primetime animated show. So with The Simpsons, we had that again. And I think you won't be surprised, Bailey, that the reason I'm bringing up The Simpsons is because after The Simpsons had been around for a while, another big deal animated show centered around a family unit, which was more outrageous in a variety of ways. It wasn't a ripoff of The Simpsons, but I think it's fair to say it's a show that wouldn't have existed if The Simpsons hadn't existed first. And of course, the show I'm talking about is, Bailey,
Family Guy.
Family Guy. Yes, indeed. Family Guy, edgier, to be sure, than The Simpsons. Maybe for didn't sure. have the impact on culture overall, like The Simpsons don't have a cowman and all the toys and all the things, but it's been a big deal show for a very long time. And I am bringing up Family Guy in particular with our audience as a roundabout way of getting to the point that, Bailey, you have arranged what?
Today I have arranged a wonderful guest, a writer, from the Family Guy world.
Oh, yeah, he's
Patrick,
in there.
Yep. Patrick Meegan. He's been a staff writer on Family Guy, I think, since season 3, I believe. I think they're coming on 25 years now of Family
Is
Guy.
Is it that long? Wow.
So really excited to talk to Patrick today. He's a TV animation writer. He also worked on Seth MacFarlane's latest TV series, Ted, which blew up, and it's already been renewed for a season 2. So I think we should get Patrick in here. I'm excited to see what he has to say.
All right. If you're ready to go, dear listeners, I now give you Patrick Meegan.
Lights, camera, action.
Hi, Brian. Hi, Bailey.
Hello, Patrick.
Hey, Patrick.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, Listen, if you want to talk about the writing craft, the true craft and art of writing, a Family Guy writer is definitely who you need to go to. So
yeah. Right. No, that yeah.
That's why we do it. It's not about commerce for us. It's not about
No. It's the art. You'd all do it for free, I'm sure.
Exactly. It's just about the craft. And I really feel like when you watch an episode of Family Guy, that's what comes across.
It does. When I'm confused about my place in the universe, I turn on Family Guy and get myself straightened out.
Sure. Yeah. What would the bards of the ages wish to communicate to us?
Right.
So I'm going to start with my question that some people find to be a softball and some people find agonizing, which is,
Why? How are you so awesome? Now, some people consider that some people call that a softball question, you know, I confess, but just how are you so great?
I don't doubt that organically we are going to touch upon why you're so awesome along the way. But let's get some other nonsense out of the way before we get to your awesomeness. Although this may be about your awesomeness in the end, which is, why are you a writer? Why write? Why do you do this to yourself?
Why do I write? Yeah, it's a very good question. I don't know. You know, I, like a lot of people, I went to high school, right? Probably all three of us did. And I remember there being a motivational speaker who came to my school once, and I remember this was a long time ago. He made a butthole joke that ended up being like very scandalous for months afterwards, and like there was the sort of tacit kind of apology from the administration, like, we never would have brought that speaker in if we knew he was going to do a joke.
A lot of pearl clutching going on.
Yeah. But one of the things that he did say that was not, on that specific subject was that, you know, and it's, I realize it's a very banal piece of advice, but that what you should do with your life is what you would do for free. And, you know, the trick, of course, is trying to fool somebody into paying you to do it for free, but that's what you should, you know, be seeking to do. And I went to college at UCLA to get my history degree, which is what I in fact got. And the thought was that I was going to be a history teacher, but along the way, I fell in with this group of people that started writing comedy sketches and stuff, and doing a little public access TV show. And I was doing that for a while before somebody finally pointed out, you know, there are people who do this for a living. There are people who write jokes and sketches and, you know, funny stuff, and this is how they pay their rent and whatever. And it just occurred to me, you know, what am I doing for free right now? I'm not like going and teaching high school history for free, as something that I just personally enjoy, but I am doing this thing, this writing thing, for free. So maybe I need to listen to the butthole speaker from, you know, several years prior. That's kind of how I ended up, sticking with this thing.
So as a teenager, or at any point previous to this public access TV you were doing the writing on, would you have labeled yourself a writer? Were you spending time writing?
No, I'd say no. I mean, I was doing like, you know, like the school play. It was like a logging town. It's this really small town in Washington State. And it's one of those deals where it's like, everybody kind of has to be in the school play, otherwise there won't be a school play. Everybody has to be on the basketball team, otherwise we won't have a basketball team, right? So when I say like I was in the school play, it's not like, oh, you must have been very artsy. Like every, you know, like half the school was in the play. But it's like, that was it. That was sort of the extent of my, you know, sort of, I don't know, artistic endeavors. So no, I did not. I certainly did not go to UCLA with a thought that like I'm a writer and I'm going to cultivate this craft.
So the thought of writing, when it was pointed out to you that some people do pay their rent this way, how did you make the leap from the free stuff you were doing to having a career?
So that's a long story, and I can always kind of like offer people the short version of the long story or the long version of the long story. So I'm going to give you the opportunity now to make your selection.
I'd like the long version of the story.
The long
please.
Version. Okay. All right. Okay. Good enough. So like I said, I was doing this public access TV show with like three or four of my friends, And but by then, and you know, even after I had sort of made my realization about what it was that I was and was not doing with my free time, it was too late to do anything about the degree that I was already well on my way towards earning. So I got my history degree, and I then moved up to Bellingham, Washington, where my then girlfriend was living. And with my UCLA history degree, I got a job at Pizza Hut because that's where she was working. And
it's always the girl.
Right, it is. And yeah. So I was doing that for a while. And then I don't want to, you know, like point fingers and make this about, you know, who dumped who, but one of us dumped me. And so then I suddenly had very little reason to be in Bellingham, Washington anymore. So I decided I was going to apply to film schools, and I got into USC film school for writing, because by then I had really kind of realized that I had enjoyed this kind of like joke and comedy writing experience and stuff. So I went to USC for grad school for their 2-year screenwriting program. And then while I was there, I decided I wanted to, somebody had mentioned something about internships, you know, being a thing. So I wrote down on somebody, I don't remember whose advice, I just kind of wrote down a list of all the TV shows at that time that I liked. And it was, at that time at least, it was a very easy thing to like get the phone numbers for the production offices of each TV show. You would just like call, you know, the main switchboards of the studios, and they just give you the phone number, which is fucking stupid. By the way, can I swear in this podcast? I don't know if this
absolutely may. We encourage it.
There's all right,
bonus,
okay.
There's bonus pay for it. So,
all right, I'm going to work in some extra swears, just just to make it worth our while here. So I just started calling, you know, these places and saying, "Hey, can I come be an unpaid intern for you?" And you know, of course, you know, they were all saying no, and I'm like, "But why? I'll work for free." And finally, there's this show called Dharma and Greg. This was a long time ago. Said, "Yeah, come on down." So I was an unpaid intern at Dharma and Greg for, you know, a year, and that was so great because the deal that I kind of made with myself was like, all right, I'm working for free, but there really is kind of a lot of just sort of like sitting around doing nothing time. And that's okay. Cause you know, I'm on the Fox lot, you know, like sometimes they'll have me deliver stuff across the lot. So they'll like take the golf cart. So I'm like driving around with a golf cart and it's like, oh, wow. I feel like I saw this in the Muppet movie or something.
Oh,
and now
yeah.
It's my real life.
What a romantic concept. Getting
it is.
Being
it's like
that the, stereotype.
Like, yeah, the last 10 seconds of Get Shorty and I'm living it. Now, yes, I'm not making money and so I have to go wait tables to actually pay my actual rent, but I'm still driving the golf cart. It's so great.
Yeah.
So, but the deal that I made with myself was like, my payment is going to be learning. So, you know, I was working in the writer's office. And of course, nobody there wanted to hear from any of the interns. Why would they? I wouldn't have wanted to hear from myself. But I was like, every day I'm going to basically corner one writer who appears in that moment to be not busy and, you know, apparently approachable. I'm just going to ask one question like, hey, I noticed that every single episode, you know, of Dharma and Greg, we only have 2 commercial breaks. Like, why is that? Why is it not 3? Why not 8? You know, why not 1? Whatever. And they'd be like, oh, well. Yes, this show, you know, has a 3-act structure of like, oh, acts is what they're called. Oh, no, I just learned something. Great. See you tomorrow. If you're stupid enough to be standing around, I'm going to ask you another question, right? And I'm like, hey, hi, it's me again. I noticed that yesterday there was a scene where Dharma went to the bank and now all of a sudden she's not at the bank. So what happened to that scene? And I'm like, oh, yeah, that scene's what we call in the industry sucked. So we cut it is what we call that. And like, oh, it's called you cut things that suck. All right. I just learned something. Right. So I did that. And it was actually like a really sort of a valuable experience for me. The whole time I was living actually in fear that I was going to get caught in that. My internship was based on one relatively large lie in that when I interviewed for it, they were like, no, you're getting college credit, right? And I was in fact going to USC, but I was not getting credit. I had not sought out that internship through the internship off at USC. And the reason is that like at USC and probably at every college, like if you want to get credit for your internship, you have to pay the university as though you're taking a class from it that you're not what? actually you're not actually taking, it's like you're working for free and you still have to like write an extra check. So I was like, fuck that noise. So they were like, you're getting paid, or you're getting college credit for this, right? And I was like, yeah. And so I was constantly waiting for them to be like, all right, we need to see your form XJ7, which all interns have, you know, or whatever. I was like, all right, I'm going to have to go home and make up a form. But right. One other thing, though, during that year of that unpaid internship was getting the opportunity to go through run-throughs. Dharma and Greg, of course, was a live action show, and it was a four-camera show. And so the way that, you know, it's sort of production week was scheduled was, you know, the writers would write, say, the table draft, and then they would have a table read, all of the actors sitting around a big table reading it out loud. And then the writers would go back and they would, you know, fix the things that didn't work. And then it would be handed off to the actors and to the director for the week, who would actually be down on the stage kind of, you know, blocking it out. And then after, you know, the sort of a day's worth of blocking it out, the the writers would all go down to the soundstage and watch a run through of this script, basically like watch a sort of a stage play version of the script. All of the actors are holding their scripts and the writers are holding copies of their scripts too, and kind of flipping through them as the run through unfolds. And they're putting a check next to the jokes that people laughed at. They're putting lines next to the jokes that nobody laughed at. And then again, the writers would retreat to their writer's room, to which unpaid interns like me were certainly not, you know, allowed entry. And they would, you know, they would do their rewrite based on that information. They would fix or cut the jokes that nobody laughed at. They would keep the jokes that people did laugh at. And then, you know, that process would sort of repeat two or three times over the course of the week, so that by the time they actually shot it, you know, they would hope this is sort of the funniest version of what the story is. So I would get to go to those run-throughs too. And then again, just kind of watch what they were doing, and then kind of like put checks and lines on my script accordingly, as though I had some sort of power, which, you know, something that I could actually do with that information, which of course I did not in any sort of formal sense. But then when the writers would come back and they'd all retreat to the writer's room to do their rewrite, I would go find just like a broom closet or some, like, you know, unused room. And I would go, let's pretend, Patrick, that you're a writer. And here's the first joke that didn't work. Let's see if you can write three jokes for this spot that, you know, you would hope might possibly be funnier than what's currently here, right? So just kind of do that and then keep flipping till I get the next joke that, you know, I know they're working on. Like, what if you were a writer, Pat? Time for you to pretend to be a writer now, right? All right, I have three jokes, whatever. And then at the end of that exercise, when I get done with the script, like, there's nothing I can do with any of that. Like, none of the writers are like, wait, maybe that fucking intern has something. So I just throw it in the garbage. But it was just sort of my own kind of personal, like I said, exercise. So I enjoyed that too. And that was another part of what I sort of was forcing myself to get out of that experience. Anyway, at the end of that year, they knew that Dharma and Greg was going to be coming back. And they said, would you like to be the night PA, which is absolutely the lowest on the totem pole you can get while getting paid. Like, now I'm above the unpaid intern. I can actually quit my job waiting tables at this very terrible Italian restaurant. And I get to be the person who is basically photocopying the script 400 times back then, because this is before PDFs exist. And then this is the job that's done. This is the last person working on the show after everyone else has gone home for the night, right? The run-through has occurred. The actors have gone home. Then the writers took their turn doing the rewrite and they're done with it. They hand it off to the writer's assistant to proofread it, and the writers go home. And then once the writer's assistant proofreads it, he hands it to me and says, here, make 600 copies and deliver it all over the city. And then he goes home, or she. And then I'm, you know, kind of all by myself with the copy machines. So a lot of my work was done kind of like relatively late at night. But again, I didn't mind. I felt like I was sort of, you know, paying my dues. And I got to see what, you know, the back gates of a lot of celebrities looked like when I'm throwing the script over them. So that was my job for another year. At the end of that second year at Dharma and Greg, the production staff got press ganged into being the production staff for this new pilot that was coming out called Titus, which was this Fox sitcom. And I got asked, would you like to be a daytime PA, right? So Now I'm really moving up in the world. I don't have the worst job in Hollywood. I've got the second worst job in Hollywood. But one of the really awesome things about that time, though, was the pilot did, in fact, have a writer's assistant. But sometimes there was more work than one writer's assistant could do. He had to rush to, you know, get, you know, changes to the script made to get to the studio or whatever. And meanwhile, Christopher Titus and the show running bosses there, Jack Kenny and Brian Hargrove, need somebody in the room to like take notes on something else that they're working on, right? So now I was getting called into the quote unquote writer's room, tiny as it was, to take notes. And that was my sort of first time actually being in the room where it's happening. Like, no longer do I have to ask, why did the bank scene get cut? Like, because it sucked. Like, I can see with my own eyes. They're right now in front of me deciding the bank scene sucks. Let's cut it. And so that was a new sort of like level of information. And then the other thing that was great about being in that room finally was that I was able from time to time to pitch jokes, which was, you know, sort of no longer am I having to write every joke on a piece of paper and then throw it away. Like, I kind of like this stuff. Like, I'm enjoying this thing. And so Titus, the pilot, ended up getting picked up. And so they asked me, would you like to stay with Titus? Dharma and Greg would be coming back for another season. Would you like to come over with us and work on this Titus show and be a writer's assistant? And I said, yes. So now I don't have the worst job in the business. I don't have the second worst job. I moved up to the third worst job in the business. So I'm definitely heading the right direction. And that was, again, so great. It was more of what I was just talking about, getting to be in the room to sort of see why certain things are going in, why certain things are not, what the kind of like internal politics of a writer's room are, like when, you know, a writer is, because, you know, you're the one person as the writer's assistant, you're the one person with his or her actual fingers on the keyboard, at least the way these rooms work. Maybe other rooms do it differently. And meanwhile, you've got 10 or 12 or 15, like very desperate, very frightened comedy writers like pitching out stuff, right? And yeah. So you have to kind of learn, like, okay, when she says something, it goes right in. When he says something, it goes in if it gets a laugh. When he says something, you know, let's kind of check with the boss and see if he wants that in, because he's kind of like a little bit out of favor. But don't make it too obvious, because then that third person's going to be pissed at you and it's going to take it out on you. So you need to kind of like be diplomatic about how you're doing it. But how do you keep all that stuff massaged while the jokes, you know, aren't going to stop coming? They're going to keep coming and piling up on each other. So there's also a lot of sort of joke triage, right? Like, okay, what jokes do I have to be sure to like get down right away versus what jokes I'm like, okay, I'm going to file that away. If we end up pursuing that sort of like, you know, branch of the tree, then I'm going to have to remember that's how we got started. But I have a hunch that that may have just been a one-off. We're not going to go down it. So I'm going to put that in my brain's kind of maybe pile. And then this person said something, and even as he was saying it, I knew he didn't mean it and is not going to be pissed at me for not putting it in. So just put that out of my mind. Like, you're having to constantly do that. And you also have to know, like, they all are like looking at a computer screen that has the script on it, and they don't have their fingers on the keyboard. They can just kind of see like, okay, I pitched my joke according to this wording, which makes sense as a joke. But then that asshole wrote these other words, which don't make sense as a joke, and ruined my gag. And now do I care enough to say, you got that wrong? Or do I keep my mouth shut about it, right? So as a writer's assistant, you kind of need to know how jokes are structured so that if you do end up having to sort of like reverse engineer what that guy said so it appears on the screen so that he doesn't get mad at you, and also PS so that it's there so we can use it if we decide it's what's best for the show, you kind of need to know like how that happens. So it's, you got to be able to type fast, but it's more than just typing fast. You got to be able to sort of think like a writer and think like a comedy writer and stuff, right? But this is all, again, like excellent. You know, learning time, right?
Absolutely.
I want to harken back. Remember, how did you make the jump from being like a unpaid writer to a paid writer? I was like, okay, there's a short version and a long version. You're like, I'll take the long version. I just want to, anybody listening, if you're regretting that, you know, Brian made that choice, so blame him and not me. Okay, so
So I am like a blame sponge. I'll okay, be
good.
All right.
Good, good, good. So at the end of that first year of Titus, the show was doing well enough to get picked up for a second season. So they asked me, hey, would you like to come on and be a writer? And I said, yes, that sounds great. So then for the second season of Titus, I was now a paid writer. So hooray for that. And so now that's kind of, I guess, the end of the story. But I'm going to keep going for just a little bit more. Because Titus,
but this part's not my fault.
Oh, this part is not my fault. No, it's right. This concludes the portion of Brian's blame, and now 100% Patrick Negan's blame. So I was on Titus for two more years, and then Titus got canceled, and then I was an unemployed person. And then what happened is that Fox had my bosses, Jack Kenny and Brian Hargrove, signed to what are called overall deals, which is, you know, and whereas I, like all these 25 years later, you know, working at Family Guy, like I still basically get paid one season at a time. And at any point, Fox or my bosses can be like, you know, that's the end of this season and Family Guy's going to keep going, but you are not. Goodbye. Right. But when you have an overall deal, it's with the studio. And even if the show gets canceled, you still are getting paid by the studio. So that was the case with Jack Kenny and Brian Hargrove. So Fox had to do something with them. So they put him together with this guy whose name is Seth MacFarlane. And he had this cartoon called Family Guy. And it had been on for 3 years and then it got canceled. But Fox was still paying him. They had an overall deal with him. So they're like, hey, Seth MacFarlane, you work together with this Jack Kenny and Brian Hargrove guy and work on some new pilot that you're doing because we're paying you. So you should at least pretend to be busy doing something so that we can kind of justify us paying you. Right. So,
right.
So Jack and Brian needed a writer's assistant at that point. And they were like, hey, Patrick, you used to be a pretty good writer's assistant before, you know, we hired you to be a writer. We can't hire you to be a writer. This is just a pilot, but would you like to come be a writer's assistant for us again? And again, I was unemployed. So I'm like, yeah, sure. I got no pride. I'll go be a writer's assistant again. So I worked on that, that pilot. Again, it was called Simon. It never got anywhere, but it's live action pilot. And again, I was able to get little jokes kind of into the pilot script. You know, ultimately didn't help. The pilot didn't get picked up. But I think by the end of that time, maybe Seth MacFarlane was like, hey, this Patrick Negan guy is okay. He's funny or whatever. So then it didn't get picked up. But then Family Guy did get sort of as you know, because it still exists, like basically got resuscitated. And
I was hoping you were going to say reanimated, or is that too on the nose?
Oh, it's right on. Sometimes it's just right in front of your face and I didn't say it. So my sort of like toes in the door were A, having worked on that pilot as a writer's assistant. So Seth kind of got to know me a little bit. B, when I was at Titus, there was a writer named Chris Sheridan who had been on like an early season of Family Guy and then basically got poached by Titus to come work on Titus for, you know, a year. And, you know, really hilarious guy. And then he, after Titus got canceled and the Family Guy got reanimated, very awesome, Brian, A+, they brought him back to be one of the two sort of co-showrunners. So I'd worked with Chris. So he, you know, remembered me and apparently thought I was an okay guy. And then C, that public access TV show at UCLA that I sort of started this story about, one of the three other guys that I was working on it with was this guy named Steve Callahan, who was a groomsman at my wedding and, you know, still one of my very best friends. He had started at Family Guy as a writer's assistant and then was put on staff and was now being brought back to be on the writing staff. And so that also was another sort of toe in the door. So those sort of three toes together were enough to get me in, to get me a meeting. And they read my sample script and they're like, this is good enough. So I got hired. And that was in April 2004, which means that this past April, it would have been 20 years exactly. So there, that is the end of the story of how I went from being not a paid writer to a paid writer.
That's a fantastic story. And as we've covered, mostly my fault. thank you for sharing all that. And I mean that sincerely, because we've got a lot of listeners who are interested in the creative process and craft and all that stuff. But a lot of people who are interested in how various industries work. And we've got a variety of types of writers listening, and we've certainly got some people who are interested in getting into the room. And I realize that writers' rooms have changed a bit, at least downsized, since some of what you're describing about the earlier days. Though perhaps a big hit show like Family Guy, maybe the writers' room hasn't downsized all that much?
Yeah, we are kind of grandfathered in. We're sort of in this kind of golden bubble, honestly, because we're still, you know, technically a network show. And although, you know, the reruns air on Hulu, and we're starting to do, you know, a couple of years sort of direct to Hulu episodes and stuff. But because we're a network show, and because, you know, we have been successful, like, we've been able to kind of like retain kind of some of the old ways that, you know, that newer shows, you know, that start up don't have quite the same luxury of. And, you know, it's just one of the million different ways that I'm incredibly fortunate. I work for a show that is sort of like a unicorn in that way, and we're protected in a way that a lot of writing staffs are not.
You've done quite a bit of writing of full episodes along the way, including some notable ones like, weren't you the guy on the Simpsons Guy crossover episode, various things like that?
Yeah, I wrote the Simpsons Guy. That was okay. That was super fun. Like, a lot of people, including, you know, very possibly you too. You guys seem like you might be sort of the age and gender demographic. I grew up watching The Simpsons and fucking loved it so much. And, you know, if there were no Simpsons, there wouldn't be a Family Guy. Like, that's just a statement of objective fact. And so, you know, I still remember like having the table read for The Simpsons Guy, and like Dan Castellaneta and Julie Kavner and, you know, Hank Azaria actually coming to the Family Guy writer's room to fucking watch Dan Castellaneta doing Homer, obviously, reading lines that you wrote. It's sort of like, this is, you know, there's nothing in my life will ever be better than this. Like, the birth of my children was kind of mid, honestly. Like, I was not that into it, but seeing Dan do Homer to, you know, jokes that I wrote, like,
what a bizarre level of responsibility to take, borrow someone else's iconic characters like that. And you've got the responsibility for story and especially dialogue that's being put into their mouths. How did that feel while you were doing the writing itself? Did it come naturally because you were such a big fan of the show and so familiar with Simpsons that it felt right as you were writing it?
Well, the other, like, well, first of all, it really is the case that they're all written by all of us, right? So, you know, at Family Guy, and probably the way it is at a lot of shows, is like, as a group, you know, the whole staff or maybe a portion of the staff might break a story together. Somebody may come in with a germ of a story or whatever, but the group will sort of break the whole story together. One person will be sent off to write the first draft, but then he or she will come back with it. And the thing will get rewritten, you know, several times by all of the writers, all, you know, however big that staff is. But then when it gets on the air, that person who was initially sent off for, you know, a week or 2 weeks to write the first draft is the one who it says written by dot, dot, dot. So you don't, and I didn't, you know, when I was off going, oh, this is such a heavy responsibility because it's all on me, because I knew anything that I wrote, like, it doesn't matter how good you write it. Like, you can do the best job in the world. Like, it's only going to be better when, you know, X number of other more talented than you, more talented than me, is what I mean to say, like, writers, like, get their chance to, like, you know, take the garbage that you wrote and make it not garbage. So that really takes a lot of sort of like personal kind of weight off of it. So that helped a lot. And then the other thing that really helped is, you know, one of my two showrunners, Rich Appel, used to be that story absolutely would not have happened if not for him. First of all, he, incredibly talented and funny person, awesome person just as a human being. And he had written for The Simpsons and still had maintained relationships with The Simpsons. So if he was not who he was, like, that show wouldn't have happened. But The Simpsons really sort of trusted him to, like, all right, we're going to loan you our iconic characters in our iconic town in an iconic state that we're not going to say what state it is. Mm-hmm. And then and trust that you're not going to fuck us over, right? And you're going to, you know, be true to who these characters are, and you're going to, like, you know, allow them to be the hilarious characters that they are or whatever. And so I really, you know, I trusted in Rich as well to sort of like to guide the process in that way. And he did. And, you know, and we ran stuff at The Simpsons, like, what about this? What about this? And they, from time to time, like, I don't think we should have Homer do that or whatever. There isn't necessarily anything comes off the top of my head, but definitely, like, there were moments where, like, you know, that's a no on Marge doing that, right? Great. Mm-hmm. But that helped too. That helped me to, you know, when I'm sitting in the local coffee shop for 2 weeks, not go like, oh, the weight, the horror. It was fine. You get to just have fun with, you know, Homer and Bart.
Do I remember correctly that was an extended episode? Was that an hour?
It was an hour. Yeah. Technically it's a quote unquote two parter. Wrote it as an hour, but I think there's some sort of studio reason way above my head why that was actually like a two parter. But it was not the intent. It was supposed to be just a half hour, but like by the time that I, you know, came back with that first draft, the whole staff was just, first of all, we couldn't believe our luck that we're getting to do this. And we're just having so much fun with, you know, with Mo, right? Mr. Burns.
Right.
That it's like, we just kind of want to keep going. We don't want to stop at a half hour. And we were fortunate enough to be able to sort of stretch that out.
Well, I asked about the hour thing because we heard in your story about when you were interning and on the lot and asking questions and learning about, oh, three-act structure. And then we heard a lot about you writing jokes, which is a tough thing to do well. And not that many people do that well with that, no matter how hard they try. But also along the way, you had to learn about story and structure to create a satisfying narrative that lasts the half hour or the hour in this case. Was there a concerted effort on your part to get good at that? Or was it immersion that it just came to you because you were around all the right people for enough hours or weeks,
I mean,
or years?
There a little bit is where like the $60,000 I spent at film school wasn't entirely wasted, right? Definitely this was not worth $60,000, but like, you know, I definitely like picked up the skill of like, okay, you read a script and it feels like what's happening? Like nothing's really happening. What's anybody doing? And you're like, all right, time to like go back to like basics here and just sort of going through the script. Because I'm an old person, right? I like to have it on paper and just physically write, you know, this scene, like, you know, Smoochie comes to town, right? All right, that's what happens in the town, right? And then like scene two, like Smoochie meets a dog, right? And then, you know, scene three, like, you know, Smoochie gets arrested, and then the whole rest of the story is about like Smoochie is, you know, in jail, and then Smoochie tries to break out, and then you go back and you're like, well, why did Smoochie meet the dog? What does that add to it? Like, I don't know, it's just, you know, just fun sometimes to meet dogs and like, all right, well, this is something we can cut. It doesn't move the story forward, right? So I spent $60,000 to learn how to find the Smoochie meets the dog scene in a script, right?
Mm-hmm.
I probably overpaid for that skill, but I did acquire that skill, so that's helpful. But
in the minds of some of our younger listeners, isn't that the price of a state school now? $60,000, I think.
I know, this was a long time ago. Right, it was only 2 years, right? So, but yeah. The other thing is like after you do it enough times, like at Family Guy, I probably have like 25 episodes or whatever, you know, credited to me. But then, you know, hundreds more that like don't have my name on it, but that I'm in the room when we're breaking the story, right? And so you learn, at the very least, you learn this, right? You learn like, okay, in a Family Guy story, oftentimes, you know, we will have a first act mislead, which is like an example, sort of going, you know, kind of back into the Family Guy, like epilogue is like, there was an episode we did called McStroke, where mm-hmm. Peter at the end of act one has a stroke. He eats so many hamburgers that he has a stroke. And then the rest of the next two acts are Peter sort of dealing with, you know, the aftermath of that stroke, right? But the first act of that was Peter grows a mustache, and then people start treating him differently because he has a mustache. And so you just kind of can get just sort of random sort of Peter with a mustache jokes. And then towards the end of Act Two, he's just walking down the street with his mustache, and like a fire truck pulls up, and like a bunch of firemen with mustaches, they're like, you have a mustache, you must be a fireman. And and Peter, right. Peter says, I don't know. I'm not a fire. I don't know how to put out fires. And like, you don't, it's like, I mean, what do? You point the hose of water at the fire until the fire goes out. Like, see, he knows everything we do. So then he has to like get in the fire truck with them, and he goes to put out the fire and succeeds in putting out the fire. And his reward is he's given like an endless supply of hamburgers, and he eats all the hamburgers until he has a stroke, right? So the story of the episode, the title of the episode is Mixed Stroke, and the story of the episode is Peter has a stroke and has to sort of like deal with it, and the rest of the Griffins have to deal with, you know, their now handicapped father. But the whole sort of first act, like, you just sort of Peter fucking around town with a mustache, you wouldn't go, oh, I know where this goes. Obviously, he's going to end up with a stroke. That first act, we call it a first act mislead. And so kind of Family Guy episodes will have that. We'll have sort of the first act mislead. And sometimes you'll, again, just through repetition, like I said, I've been doing this 20 years, like you'll have a story. Somebody will have like a germ of a story where, you know, Peter, I don't know, this pulling this out of my butt, right? But Peter finds a bulletproof vest and it's just sort of enjoying going around town, like, you know, getting himself in danger. Cause like, what's the worst that can happen? Him, he's wearing a bulletproof vest, right? And so you might be like, okay, so what happens in Act Two? Like, what's kind of the big sort of turn or whatever? And you start going, it feels more like a first act mislead. Like, I feel like we could come up with Peter has a bulletproof vest jokes and him sort of insulting guys with guns and stuff, but that doesn't feel like a real story. It just sort of feels like we get a few gags out of it. So this, all this stuff that we're doing to try and sort of like end of Act Two and make it a real kind of quote unquote emotional story, which basically no Family Guy story really ever is, but kind of our version of one, like it feels misplaced. And that the reason probably is because we all can kind of sense that it really kind of belongs in the first act. And so we need to find some place for, we basically need to just sort of blow through all our bulletproof vest jokes in Act One, and then find some way for it to turn into something that can be a real story that actually sort of affects other people besides Peter. And now we have a story. And sometimes you can't. And so then sometimes it just sort of like sits off someplace. Like, you know, Peter has a blazer. I don't think we ever did it, but like Peter has a blazer has been like a first act mislead that comes up for like 15 years now. Like, it's funny if Peter has a blazer. He starts walking around. He starts acting different because he's wearing a blazer. We're like, yeah, that's funny. But then what happens? And we never really can come up with what the next thing happens. So like, all right, let's put blazer on the shelf again. So, but the lessons for that in terms of like storytelling, like, might very well be incredibly limited only to within the four walls of our own show, right? Like if you know, Seth MacFarlane, God forbid, slips on a bar of soap tomorrow and dies in the shower, right? And it's like, okay, I need to get another job, which, you know, on day one, right? Like, all right, we need to break a story. I'm like, okay, how about Peter finds a blazer, right? It's very possible that the things that I've spent 20 years doing again and again and again and again might not be at all relevant or useful anywhere except for on this one specific TV show.
Well, I can see that. We had Michael Jamin on recently, who has written for King of the Hill, and we discussed a little bit when he was on the degree to which King of the Hill is, it's animated, but that doesn't really bring any particular utility. It's a straight sitcom that happens to be animated.
Right.
Family Guy sort of at the other end of the spectrum. You have interesting fourth wall breaks and cutaway gags and things like that. It needs to be an animated show. And then on top of that, pretty bizarre in its techniques and its vibe often. So yeah, I could imagine, God forbid, you find yourself on a different show. That could be some real shell shock, changing the rhythm of your writing and your expectations as a participant in the writer's room?
Yeah. So, you know, prayers up to Allah that the show stays on the air and I never have to run into that problem. I really was going to ask something or say something and I totally stepped right on.
Oh, no, I was just going to actually say, I think you guys do a very good job with your structure and I think you actually can learn something from it. Episodes like, and then there were fewer. Yes, it's a two-parter. Yes, it's maybe it's longer episodes, but the story is really well done. I think, you know, even though it's an animated show, it knows what it is. It's so anyway, my question was, I grew up on Family Guy. So a lot of my favorite show or episodes are like season 1 to 4, 1 to 5, because it's just, it's a little bit more controversial. It's a little, sure. But it was also a different time, right?
Yeah.
So you guys are still the same show. I think you do a brilliant job, but still pushing the boundaries and the jokes you make. Is there a difference now? Like if you pitch a joke that you would pitch in 2004, you can't really pitch that today? Or like, what? How does that work in the writer's room?
I don't know. Because like the culture's changing, but you're sort of changing along with it, right? So it's like...
Yeah, yeah.
And so much of this is subconscious, right? So if it's 2004 and you're pitching a joke and you're kind of realizing as you're pitching it, this is kind of on the edge. Like, I'm comfortable with it, but I'm just sort of like barely comfortable with it. 20 years later, you know, you pitch a joke, you're like, this is kind of on the edge. I'm mostly comfortable with it, not 100% comfortable with it, but that's kind of where I want this joke to be. Like, you know, that line may have changed, but you don't have like a constant sort of view of that line. You don't get like mm-hmm. whatever, you know, a time, you know what I'm saying. So, see, it just kind of like goes by feel. I mean, there are certain like words where it's like, that's a literal truth. You just are like, you can't say midget anymore. And it's like, all right, this is not something that anybody could ever sort of like test, right? But like, when I think about Family Guy and some of the kind of like edgier or like, ooh, is that okay? Kind of like jokes or moments or whatever. I think that Family Guy is a little bit grandfathered in. I think that it's possible that we get away with some jokes that, like, if we right. were a brand new show called, you know, Clan Person, right? Not family, clan maybe is not the right word, but whatever is a good
with a C,
yeah, C. Thank you. Yeah, good. Yeah, yeah. Right. And you write some of the same jokes, like, you know, you might be told, no, you really kind of can't do that. But I sort of feel like we get a little more leeway because it's like, oh, it's Family Guy. It's what they do. It's what they've always done. So it must be okay. And also there's a part of me that believes that, well, first of all, like, you know, I tell people, for example, I, you know, have been telling my children when they were old enough to watch the show, like, I hope you understand, we're not, you know, Peter says this racist thing here, right? Or Brian says this thing that's really kind of very homophobic, or Stewie says this thing, it's really kind of anti-Semitic. I hope you realize we're not laughing at that racist joke. We're not laughing at that homophobic joke. We're laughing at Peter, that he would be so stupid to say that, right? We're laughing at Brian, that he would be so kind of like vain and off base to kind of like go there with his brain.
In a perfect magical world where you could see into everyone's heads, it should be the intent in something that really matters. Not the words, but the intent. Because you can use some pretty innocuous words to say some terrible things, and you can use some pretty terrible words to say some innocuous or cute things. But I recognize what the trap is if you try to make one of your characters a horrible idiot by having them use some slur that they obviously shouldn't be using in 2010. And then the social contract changes a bit by 2024. And now we've gone from, we recognize how terrible that slur is, to we do not speak that slur. That's a bit of a trap.
That's definitely one of the hazards of, you know, of being on a show this long. It's like you're around long enough to see society change, right? And so yeah. And so yeah, so then the joke that, like, especially because it's a cartoon, you can't like look at it and go, oh, Stewie looks younger, so blah blah blah. Like, Stewie basically looks the same throughout. So you don't realize that joke that you're horrified at in 2024, like, oh, that was actually written in 2003. Like,
blew my mind a little bit because I've never really considered that aspect that you don't look at an episode and likely recognize it as an artifact of the past.
No,
because
but
the art styles haven't changed much for most shows. I mean, South Park, if you go way back, you can tell.
And if you're real, like if you look at like season one of Family,
yeah, like
Guy,
early seasons, you can, sure, yeah,
super early, you can kind of tell. But long about season four or so, it kind of looks the same as now, honestly. And the voices really, you know, Alex Borstein in season one was, you know, Lois sounded different than she does now. But to my ears, Lois has sounded the same since 2005. You know, So but no, you're right. And
she just pitched it a bit.
Yeah, exactly. And maybe slightly less nasal, maybe, than when it started.
Pina.
Yeah, Pina. another thing is, because our production process takes so long, like, you know, an episode that we start writing, like, isn't going to get on the air for a year and a half. Sometimes a joke, we're like no longer comfortable. We were comfortable with this joke a year and a half ago, but we're not comfortable with it anymore. And to me, the sort of classic version of that was, we had a gag that was like, it was a fake commercial, and it was Elton John presents, you know, the greatest hits of Elton John now with their original gay titles. So the implication was like, you know, Elton John jokes that he wrote, but, you know, before he came out, but now that he's gay, like here's what he really meant to call it. Just within the time that it took to produce that episode, much less the 20, you know, years of that I've been on the show, we no longer felt comfortable doing. And so it went away.
So lest our listeners come away from this thinking you're just Mr. Funny Joke Writing Guy, what does your process look like? How do you actually get the pages done? Are you a morning writer or a late night writer? Do you outline? Do you write by the seat of your pants? Just kind of, how do you get the damn work done?
No, so we definitely outline. Definitely, sir, I kind of need to know what's in this. Again, after 20 years, it's hard to know sort of where Family Guy ends and where like old Patrick's process begins. But
sure.
But definitely, you know, as a result of, you know, what it is that I've been doing, like I definitely have like a scene by scene outline, you know, like a general idea. But, you know, as I go into each scene, sort of where, like, what's funny about it, right? Like, where am I going to go to for a joke to kind of like break up moments, you know? And then I can kind of go into it, and a couple of jokes will have come to me even sort of like in the outline. And then I can go into the actual sort of writing of it and start fleshing it out and finding a couple more jokes that maybe like I didn't sort of realize were there from the outline, but they kind of become apparent to me. I'm a morning writer. I find that I get my best work done like as early in the day as possible. That first cup of coffee goes great with those first couple of pages.
And, oh, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And for me, for writing comedy in particular, like any more than about 5 to 6 pages, and that's kind of it for the day. Like I can't like go, I'm going to write 20 pages of comedy today, because maybe some people can, but I just kind of, I know it's, you know, the jokes on page 19 are not going to be funny. That's just kind of going to be me just sort of like trying to kind of fill out the pages. But if I really just kind of knuckle down for like 4 or 5 pages, I can do it. And Family Guy happens to be a show that's very joke heavy. I have worked on other projects where it's like, you get it, you know, you're writing the script, like you get a joke in and you're like, okay, all right. So I got that joke in. I've earned myself a little time here to kind of like check in with the other characters. Like, let's sort of see, you know, where they are emotionally at this point. Oh boy, it's been about, you know, it's been about a page and a half, time to start thinking about angling towards what the next joke will be, right? At Family Guy, it's like, no, it's joke. It's like fucking storming the beach at Normandy. It's like, joke, what's the next joke? What's the next joke? There's no kind of like resting and kind of regaining your bearings and resetting motivations and stuff. So 5 pages of that, and I'm usually wiped.
So Patrick, when you're not writing and you're not acting, I recognize that bank teller and a few voices, you're producing. So what was it like being a producer on, you were a consulting producer on TED, the TV series, if I'm right? Or so, IMDb tells me so?
It's, yeah, IMDb lies to you. So title is true, but it's all just writer. You know, when you're watching, again, Family Guy or Ted or whatever, it's like, oh, so-and-so is a co-executive producer, so-and-so is a consulting producer, so-and-so is, you know, executive story editor.
Right.
They're all just writers and they're all just in the room. It's just sort of this like, you know, a little bit kind of like, oh, this writer makes a little more money than this writer does, right? Or whatever, or this writer has been around for a little longer. But in the writer's room, it's all just 20 writers in the room. And like, if you're trying to get a spot and like three people are pitching a joke for that spot, right? It's not evaluated, but like, okay, no, wait a second. The executive story editor pitched this, but the consulting producer pitched this. So what's the hierarchy? It's sort of like whoever got the funniest joke in there is what goes in. So I have no actual, and God bless you, Bailey, God bless you, but I have no actual production duties or responsibilities. I just write diarrhea jokes for a living.
Are we going to one day get a Family Guy movie? Is that something that's going to...
Yeah, there's nothing in the immediate offing, but like, you know, I would not be... you know, completely shocked if like, you know, next time, you know, I'm talking to my bosses, they're like, okay, good news. You know, we're getting to work on a Family Guy movie. Like, I wouldn't be like, what the fuck? I'd be like, okay, right. All right, finally time. But there's right. there's not anything that's currently going.
Well, thank you so much, Pat.
We'll keep our hopes up anyway. Okay. You can't stop us.
No, so. We can't. I don't have that power.
Thank you so much, Patrick. It's been a pleasure.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Patrick.
Have
Be
a great
in touch.
Day.
See ya.
Okay, talk to you guys later. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Very interesting hearing how Patrick got where he is in the industry. The way he started as an assistant and did everything he could to observe and ask all the right questions without being a pest. And I feel like someone listening to that story might very reasonably say, oh, sounds like he got kind of lucky, but I need a better strategy than that to get my career started. And sure, but also I don't know about that, because listening to his story just makes me think how everything involves some luck. And you can easily be the most talented writer on earth, whatever that means, and still not have career success. You know, people say, oh, you've got to make your own luck. And it's a pithy thing that people like to throw around when they don't know what else to say. But also, it's kind of true in a useful way. What I'm saying is, no matter how talented you are, you do have to make your own luck by putting yourself in the right situations, around the right people, asking the right questions, and knowing when to close your damn mouth while you kind of camp out and wait for that right moment, the luck, in air quotes, to come along. And you'll hear about emerging writers who finished their first big whatever, and they email it off, and the right person sees it, and suddenly there's a bidding war in Hollywood. And that actually does happen. Sometimes success shows up that way. But I guess my point is, you just shouldn't be counting on that kind of experience. You should be busy making your own luck. And it's never just one thing, right?
No, never. There's, you know, I love what you just said there, Brian. There's a famous video of James Cameron and he's being interviewed. It's sort of something like, you don't get an opportunity in Hollywood, you take an opportunity, which I think is true.
Yeah.
And I don't think you can take an opportunity unless you do make your own opportunity, which is kind of what you've just sort of been saying there.
There isn't one magic formula that's going to get you anywhere. The magic formula is going to be all of your efforts put together.
Exactly. And when Patrick at the top, I knew he would say something like that. You want to talk to a Family Guy writer. You probably want to get real deep, don't you? And really get thematic, all that kind of stuff. And you know what? Making people laugh every episode, that is difficult. That is not easy.
Yep.
And all that kind of writing is meaningful.
And I agree with what you were saying about the value of making people laugh. It's not just hard to do, but once you've accomplished it, there's a lot of value. People need to laugh. It's important work. And yeah, I was also very amused by what Patrick had to say at the top as we started the interview. But also, that's him being funny and being humble at the same time. And now that we've had this time chatting with him, it seems absolutely perfectly on brand. So
oh, yeah.
I'm extremely appreciative.
I really enjoyed this conversation, Brian, and I really agree with what you said there and with everything that we discussed with Patrick.
And with that, a final big thanks to our guest this episode, the eminently entertaining and very generous television writer-producer, Patrick Meegan. And thanks as well to Story Summit for making this podcast possible. To meet other writers, turbocharge your craft, and learn about career opportunities writers really care about, it does not get any better than the generous people at Story Summit. Please do take a moment to check them out soon at storysummit.us. Thank you for listening, everyone, and until next time, keep writing. And if a career as a writer is a goal of yours, well, look, you're going to hear a lot of people telling you no, but please don't ever give up, because all it takes is that one yes. I've been your host, Brian Landwehr, this episode produced by myself and Bailey Patterson, with the support of David Paul Kirkpatrick of Story Summit.
I hope to be a writer myself someday.
Original music by Kenton Edwards.